This summer, I read a book, a novel, called A Prayer for Owen Meany. Anybody read it? John Irving? And the story is about a man, Johnny. He's the man who's writing the story. His entire life, he searches and searches for the father he never met. His father never did, or his mother never did reveal who his father was before she died. But through the years, and over those years of deducing and trying to figure out the story of his mom's life, he's very convinced, quite convinced, that his father must be a resident of the small town that he lives in. He must be one of those men. You know, this isn't all that different than those of us who wonder and wonder what God is like, who God is. We've heard that he's close, but we're just not sure who he is because we can't see him. And so we wonder and wonder who he might be. Throughout the Old Testament, we learn that no one can see God. And in fact, we learn that there's no way that a human could even handle seeing God or encountering who God truly is. And so Paul, in his letter to the Colossians, he comes out of his opening greetings and prayer, and he launches into the main point of his letter. It's the point that's actually going to shape everything else. And the point that he wants to make is he wants to pull back the dramatic curtain to reveal who God is. Paul is going to tell us who God is. He's going to reveal this hidden God, this God whom we cannot handle seeing. And of course, Paul is going to do this using an amazing string of metaphors. A metaphor is a word or a phrase used to compare two unlike things, objects or ideas or thoughts or feelings. It's going to compare those two things in order to provide a clearer description of what you're talking about. An example of a metaphor would be when you call a dependable father a rock. Okay? Now, Paul, as we've noticed over the last couple weeks, as we've been living in this book of Colossians, we've recognized that Paul loves metaphors. He just keeps coming back to them. Maybe the reason that Paul loves metaphors so much is because God is so big and so unknowable, he escapes human language. How can we describe who God is? And so Paul, in very quick succession, uses metaphor after metaphor to reveal who this amazing God is. So first of all, it's like Paul says, step up to this mirror. Step up and look into this mirror. Now, as we look into the mirror, maybe we're expecting we're going to see ourselves, but we step up and he declares, the Son of God, Jesus Christ, is the image of the invisible God. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. All that you've ever wondered about God, all that has felt like a mystery about who God is, all that has remained unknowable is now made fully available. The Son is the image of the invisible God. You may be surprised. You may not discover what you expected to discover. But Paul explains, Jesus is the perfect image of God. In Paul's letter to the Hebrews, we looked at this way back in the spring. We kept coming back to this first part of this letter that he writes to the Hebrews, where he says, "In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word." Jesus is the exact representation of God's being, the image of the invisible God. So if you want to see God, if you want to know God, look to Jesus. That's how you can know God. In fact, Paul says, Jesus is the firstborn over all creation. What does that mean? Well, in the ancient world especially, the firstborn is the person who inherits it all. The person who gets it all. Anything that there is, anything that has been made or earned or developed, it's all going to the firstborn. Before you, though, you start kind of believing that Jesus kind of showed up later on the scene, and he just reaped the benefits of his Father's work. No, Paul very quickly clarifies that Jesus himself is creator. He says, "For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him." It's like an incredible artist. This is Claude Monet. It's like an incredible artist who creates artwork, but then also fills his own property for it, with it. It's like everything is created through him and for him. And so Jesus is creator and receiver, because all things were created through him, but also for him. Next, metaphor. Paul says he's before all things. It's the classic, "I was here first." Who hasn't said that at least once? Might have been quite a few years ago, but "I was here first." And we all know what that means. And that means that if I was here first, then I'm the boss of what's happening here, right? He was before all things. He's in charge. Next, Paul says, "In him, all things hold together." I was trying to get my brain around what's the metaphor exactly that Paul's using. And it could be as simple as maybe like a spider web being held together at one particular point. But maybe even more dramatic or all-encompassing is if you imagine the magnetic gravitational pull that holds an atom together. The nucleus of the atom that pulls the electrons stay within and close to that nucleus of that one tiny atom. And then you picture the universe, and you picture the solar systems of the Earth, or of the universe, and you think of how many suns there are and how many planets are pulled into the gravitational force of those suns, way beyond what we will ever be able to understand. In the expanse of the universe, that gravitational pull from the atom to the solar systems of the universe, in all things, they are held together by Jesus. Jesus is the magnetic gravitational pull. Do you believe, do you comprehend that in Jesus all things hold together. Jesus is the force that holds everything together. And so we're starting to get this sense of Jesus' cosmic position, and we can hardly take it in. He is the complete king and ruler, creator, the one who holds all together, all that ever has been and all that ever will be. Then Paul moves on and he says, Jesus is the head of the body, the church. What does this mean? Does it mean simply that Jesus is one of the body parts over that makes up the group of people of all time that have followed God? No, it means that Jesus is the head. Jesus is the center of operation, the key pin, the command central. Nothing happens in your body without the involvement of the brain, without the head. All speech must come from the head. All hearing is received from the head. The command center of the brain runs the body. You see, the body is nothing without the head. And so the church is nothing without Jesus. We all would normally nod at that and go, yes, of course. But do we fully understand? Do we fully live like this is true? Jesus is the head of all who follow and love him. Jesus is the head of his kingdom, the eternal existence of his story, his plan, his will, his reign, and all who are part of that. It's all about Jesus. Paul goes on and he says, Jesus is the firstborn from among the dead. He's not just the firstborn, but he's the firstborn among the dead. What a curious expression. Jesus is not just the creator of the original creation, the creation that we would maybe consider having become becoming flawed, because now it does hold evil, and it holds suffering, and it holds pain, and it holds disappointment. But Paul is revealing it to us, as we can handle it, that this Jesus is creator of the old creation, but he is also creator of the new creation. He is both the original originator and the one who redeems the original into something beautiful, full of his glory. Jesus is first born from among the dead. You see, he has left no aspect of creation out of his reach. Even death, he has tasted it, he has experienced it, and he rules it all. Jesus has conquered death. He's been there, and he's conquered it. And he now, it is under his name. So Psalm 139 says, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed in the depths, you're there. Jesus is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have supremacy. In everything. Supremacy, the state or condition of being superior to all others in authority, power, or status. And you're starting to get this sense of feeling how wide and how deep and how high and long this Jesus power is. Are you needing to hold on to your head in a sense? Paul continues, he says, for God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him. The metaphor here is filling a container up, like right up to the very, very top, full, full, full. Are you starting to grasp what this poster might mean? Jesus is everything. all the fullness of God dwelling in him. Can you feel the push on your mind and your heart to comprehend this Jesus who is everything? God said to Isaiah, he said, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." It's true, we cannot comprehend the fullness of God, the fullness that is in Jesus. We are utterly separate from him in that we cannot understand. We cannot wrap our minds around. We cannot relate to this supremacy of Jesus. For this Jesus who is supreme has done something that is even more unfathomable than this. Paul says, God reconciles all things, heaven and earth, to himself through Jesus. God reconciles all things. In the beginning, in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, they chose to walk away from God. They chose to go their own way, not God's way. And God created them and us with the ability to do that. He's made us to have free will, to be able to make that very choice. And Paul talks about this parting of ways when Adam and Eve walked away. He names it as alienation, becoming completely unknown to one another. He uses the metaphor here of enemies. That's how far apart. Enemies at war. Two sides which are not on the same page. In fact, two sides that are completely at odds with one another in values, in goals, in everything. You see, since that very moment of walking away from God and that ongoing trajectory of humanity of walking away from God, God's story has been about being in pursuit of us, his people. Even though we, as people, have often treated God as an enemy, we have behaved in ways that only an enemy would. God has been planning and working on his rescue plan since the very, very moment of that turning away. And his method, his rescue plan, involved sending his son, actually sending his very self to die for us all. So how does God reconcile everything back to himself? He reconciles everything by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Is that not the weirdest paradox? To make peace through blood shed. And to us in Canada today, in 2017, that's just really odd. How in the world does God make peace through the shedding of blood? The metaphor here, we have to remember, is the metaphor of enemies at war. Enemies fighting, because that is the way we have responded and acted and behaved towards God. You see, in a fight, in a war, when blood is shed, when death comes, there is no more to be said. It's done. There's no more fight. The battle is over. Paul's next verses, he explains this enemies needing reconciliation kind of metaphor. He says, "Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation. The evil, the horrible choices, the pain and the tears and the messes that we have all made in our free will have been paid for. The punishment taken care of. You see, Jesus stepped in and he said, I'll carry every one of those consequences. I will take it. I'll carry those consequences of death and dead end. And he died for us. He did this so that we could be free of blame, free of shame, free of those horrible choices. He did this so that the war of enemies could be over, so that peace and reconciliation could come. He chose to die in our place in the war that we pretended to happen. And so the God who is everything not only stands as everything, but he also reconciles all that is not right, all that is out of place. He sacrifices his very self in order to bring all things back together again in his love. And so Paul says, this reconciliation, it remains as you continue in your faith, established and firm. The metaphor of a strong and established house. This foundation that's secure, this established and firm in your faith, he says. And he says, do not move from the hope of the gospel. The good news of Jesus, don't move. Stay put, stay right at home in the middle of this gospel news about Jesus' power. Stay in the established firm place, right inside the undeniable truth of Jesus' supremacy, his power, his might, his glory. Stay right at home in the center of his reconciliation strength. Don't move. Stay. Don't go wandering off in other directions, trying out this and that, looking for other things, because there is nowhere else to go. Stay at home in the one who is everything. Stay at home. This is the gospel, the good news, life-changing news, big, big stuff. Paul says this is the gospel that you've heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven and of which I, Paul, have become a servant. Paul has given his life to be a servant of this news. This reality of Jesus being everything, Jesus having all supremacy, having all authority, being king and master and ruler and creator and sustainer of all. You see, a servant gives over his life, gives his energy, gives his time, his efforts, his hopes, his motivation to the hopes, dreams, and agenda of the master. That's what a servant does. Lending all of your effort, all of your hope and motivation to the agenda of the master. And so Paul's life, his purpose is to serve this powerful Jesus, to let his life be shaped by the direction and movement and motivation and purposes of this Jesus power. Whether he's free or whether he's in captivity or whether he's feeling strong or whether he's feeling weak, Paul says, I am a servant of this Jesus power. So what are we going to do? What are we going to do with this mighty reality of the reign of Jesus over all things, over heaven and earth? What are we going to do with this mind-blowing truth of Jesus' resources and power and authority and reconciling action? What do we do with it all? I kind of feel that Paul just lays it out pretty straight. He says, first of all, stay home in Jesus' power. Stay home in Jesus' power. Don't move. Stay right in the middle of it. Stay right in the middle of the magnitude of who Jesus is. Stay home. And then he suggests, simply by his own example, his own life, Paul says, be a servant to this powerful Jesus. Give it over. Give all your effort, all your energy, give it all to this Jesus. You see, if we stay at home in Jesus' power, the only way to stay at home in the middle of Jesus' power is going to be as a servant. Do you realize? You see, given all the reality of who Jesus is, it is really quite ludicrous that we set out to rule our own kingdoms and queendoms, right? It's kind of crazy. What are we thinking? But we do it. You see, we are so convinced. We just are not comfortable with serving someone else. Just like Adam and Eve, we have this built-in assumption that we can't quite trust anyone else to know what is best. We can't quite trust someone else, especially to know what's best for me. And so we lean into our own stuff instead of leaning in to his and where the fullness of life is. But Jesus, who is everything, declares to us in the middle of his very might and strength and authority and power, and he says, if anybody wants fullness, it is only, and I mean only, going to be found in him, in staying home in the middle of his power. All the fullness resides in him. There is no other fullness. And so will we choose to stay at home? Will we choose to serve the one who has given absolutely everything in order to rescue and save and fill us with this real and holy divine life? So my two questions, I think you can kind of already guess what they are. How? How can we stay at home in Jesus' power? How can you be a servant to this powerful Jesus? What does that actually look like in the context of your story? And I'm not going to go on and on. I'm just going to throw out a few things that come to mind. Only to get you started, okay? How can you stay at home in Jesus' power? The first thing that comes to my thinking is gratitude. This is from last week's sermon. Like a lot of these were thrown out at everybody. Gratitude. It's like this playful inner response to who God is. It's this acknowledgement all the way along in everything. This gratitude that says, you did this, God. You were responsible for this. This is from you. Gratitude, this way of life that is full of recognizing Jesus' power. The other thing that comes to mind immediately for me, that to live and stay at home in Jesus' power might be about Sabbath rest. We've talked only a little bit about Sabbath rest, but maybe you can kind of get this picture. When we rest, like a holy kind of rest that is aware that we are resting because of God, I'm protecting the wrong side. When we rest in the Sabbath rest, we acknowledge that it is not all about my effort and how much I can get done and how hard I try and how I don't give up and how I stick with it. That isn't actually what makes the world go around. When we choose a Sabbath kind of rest, a holy stopping to acknowledge God, we say, actually, the resources are from you, Jesus. Actually, the movement of what needs to happen in my life and in the movement of the world is actually from you. It is not all about me. That's what happens when we stop and rest. So, a couple ideas. Gratitude and Sabbath rest. I wonder about staying at home in Jesus' power. How can you be a servant to this powerful Jesus? One of the things that comes to mind is actually by listening and obeying. We say this to our children all the time. Are you listening and obeying me? Well, it's actually kind of a simple concept that we would actually listen to the God of all, the Jesus who is everything, that we would actually listen and then we would respond. If our ears are stopped up, if our thinking is all about my agenda, we will not be able to hear the agenda of God. And so it is only in listening that we will ever be able to hear what it is he'd have us do and have us be. And that's what a servant does. I think about Dr. Mono, actually. So Dr. Mono is a man who grew up with nothing, very like extreme poverty, even in the context of Haiti. And he grew up as a little boy, and because of some different events in his life, he got it in his mind that he wanted to be a doctor because he wanted things to be different. He did not want death and sickness to take life, like what he was seeing around him and experiencing. And so over time, through crazy sequences of events, things like living homeless, sleeping on a hard bench in a church after having kind of made his way to the Dominican Republic, trying to get into a med school because he could not get into a med school in Haiti because he didn't know the right people and he wasn't, you know, it's all about connections and all this stuff. He finds his way to the Dominican Republic and he sleeps on a hard bench in a church, teaching himself Spanish by reading the leftover newspapers from other people every day. And he struggles and struggles so that he can learn enough Spanish so that he can go to school. He becomes a doctor this way. By tenacity and stick-with-itness and hard work, incredible hard work. His own elbow grease, in a sense. And so eventually, Dr. Mono finds his way back to his home community to be a doctor. And he begins working for a clinic, but there is no money to pay him. And this particular man, who knows exactly what it is to have nothing, has seen the devastation of that, has felt the horror of that. The person who has put so much into getting this education, he says, I will be a doctor for nothing. Because what has been given to me is not mine. What I have been given, this education, this ability to be the doctor, is not mine. So he is acting as a servant to Jesus. He's acting as someone who is working off of someone else's agenda. His life is not all about his own rights and his own comfort and his own what he's earned, but he becomes a servant to the Jesus power, to the powerful Jesus at work in the world and in him. So, how can you stay at home in Jesus' power, and how can you be a servant to this powerful Jesus? Let's pray. So Jesus, in light of who you are, in light of your incredible power, your resources that we will never be able to even begin to comprehend. In light of all of this, will you pull us home again? Will you keep us at home in the middle of who you are and your power and your glory? Will you pull us home? And Jesus, even if it requires world turned upside down for us, even if it requires huge shifting for us, will you develop in us a motivation, a strong desire that our lives would be about service to you, that our lives would be shaped by your agenda, your movement in the world. And so be at work in us, powerful Jesus. We trust. Amen.